Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a mistrial in Baltimore, a Paris Accord, more debate, and lots of national security talk. A hung jury in the case of Baltimore police officer William Porter in the death of Freddie Gray. Protesters not happy.
No justice!
No peace!
No racism!
Police!
More GOP debate in Las Vegas. Jeb calls Trump the chaos candidate.
He's a chaos candidate, and he'd be a chaos president.
Mr. Trump, Jeb doesn't really believe I'm unhinged. He said that very simply because he has failed in this campaign.
And a landmark climate change deal in Paris. President Obama applauded the accord.
This agreement represents the best chance we've had to save the one planet that we've got.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Robert Costa of The Washington Post, Nancy Youssef of The Daily Beast, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see in Syria negotiations, federal spending, the GOP field, Paris? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And listeners, some fine news. iTunes has named the On Point podcast to its best of 2015. If you miss a broadcast, our podcast is always there. Lots of great shows. Subscribe at iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. You can link at our website, onpointradio.org. Best of 2015. We love that. Joining me now from Washington is Robert Costa, national political reporter at The Washington Post, now political analyst for NBC News and MSNBC. Robert Costa, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
It's great to be here, Tom. Thank you.
Also from Washington, Nancy Youssef is with us, senior national security correspondent for The Daily Beast. She knows the Middle East and much more. Nancy, welcome. Great to have you back as well.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Bob, and Nancy.
Nancy, can you take us first to these Syria talks that are going on in New York right now? The United States is there, Moscow is there, Iran is there. Maybe you can give us a sense of who else and whether or not these really matter. John Kerry has talked a lot about these talks, but is there something that can happen here that might clean up this mess that seems to have the Middle East just unraveling?
Well, it is incredibly complicated. We're starting to see concessions from the United States, where 4 years ago the United States said Assad must go. This week we heard from Secretary of State John Kerry that was not a fundamental requirement in any sort of peace settlement, which meant that you could now open talks with Russia. There are so many competing interests that it's very hard to see how a political settlement has worked out. For example, who is at the negotiating table? Which group is declared a terrorist? Which group is declared moderate? And by whom? And so it's the very first step in a very long and complicated effort to reach a peace settlement, with the understanding that these military campaigns are no more likely to bring an end to this conflict than a possible negotiated settlement, but a more promising outcome. So we're starting to see the very early signs of both Russia and the United States trying to reach some sort of middle ground, such that we can start to set up a framework for a negotiated settlement.
And Nancy, explain how, if they did get somewhere, and it's hard to see because, I mean, we've seen repeated reports that Russia is not going after any of the people the U.S. wants them to go after, but if they did, how would a Syria agreement relate to taking on ISIS?
Well, that's a great question. So Russia's argument is, in fact, that they have gone after some ISIS targets, not to the extent that the United States would want. But what has to be agreed on is, at first, who can be at the negotiating table. For example, Jabhat al-Nusra controls territory in Syria, but has been declared a terrorist organization. The groups that the United States consider moderate, Assad says, are terrorists and that he won't talk to them. The fact that Assad is now part of the negotiations, what does Turkey want? What does the Sunni states want, led by Saudi Arabia? And so it's working out who is a legitimate actor, if you will, in the settlement, and what is an acceptable outcome. And what we saw this week was both sides, both Russia and the United States, budging slightly, the United States more so. Because while the United States said that Assad no longer has to go, and as John Kerry put it, that the United States and Russia are, quote, fundamentally similar, Russia has sort of suggested that its steadfast support of Assad is no longer. And so just agreeing on who needs to be at the table and at what are the most basic terms is where we are right now.
I can't tell if it really matters or not. We had Ash Carter this week in Turkey on Tuesday talking about this is a bigger issue, but talking about getting more of the global community to step up in the fight against ISIS.
We need our allies and partners around the world to step up and do more. And that's true in Europe. It's true in the Gulf. It's true by Europe, I mean all of NATO, including Turkey. And it's really true everywhere in the world where this is metastasizing.
Some sound system sounds like Darth Vader. Robert Costa, metastasizing. Do these talks look like critical stuff or sideshow as politicians in the U.S. talk war, Robert?
It's a fascinating contradiction for many of these Republicans because the talks are going on. But I've been covering this presidential campaign, and you're seeing not so much an intensity or a scrutiny of these ongoing discussions and even the conflict on the ground. But it's a high-pitched hawkishness you see from the candidates on the trail as they respond to voter anxiety. And the party really moves to the right in how it talks about war.
I want to come back to issues of war, national security, Islamic State strategy, also big tussle that we've seen year after year on Capitol Hill. This week, not ending in a tussle, but apparently in a deal on federal spending. Here was House Speaker Paul Ryan on Wednesday saying that compromises were coming together for a budget deal.
In divided government, you don't get everything you want. Republicans didn't get all that we wanted. Democrats didn't get all that we wanted. This is a bipartisan compromise. It's a bicameral compromise. And I understand that some people don't like some of the aspects of this, but that is the compromise that we have.
Jack Beatty, we've become accustomed to these becoming, you know, really awful knockdown, drag out, stop the government and all the rest. This time that doesn't appear to be happening. How has Paul Ryan pulled this off? His so-called Freedom Caucus, or at least under John Boehner, they were not willing to cooperate. Maybe they're not even in here, but Democrats have come in a large enough number, along with lots of Republicans, to apparently have this thing on a road to passage.
Yes, I'm looking at a photograph of Ryan in the Financial Times above a podium that says, Confident America. Well, you're pretty confident in him. He's worked out a compromise. And as he says, not everybody gets all of what they want. The Democrats had to give up on a big thing for them. U.S. oil will now be exported for the first time in 40 years. On the other hand, they got an expansion of tax credits for wind and solar power. The White House was able to block attacks on climate change policies, on financial reform, and eliminate the threat of cutting off federal funding for Planned Parenthood, and also the Syrian refugees. The Republicans had to give up on that. On the other hand, on rejecting them. On the other hand, the bill does tighten requirements on visa admitting the country, admitting travel visas to the U.S. for 38 countries. Back and forth, a compromise. The Democrats had to give way, the White House, painfully on the Cadillac tax pay for Obamacare. That'll be postponed. That's a big deal. The medical device tax, also postponed. Big hit for the White House. On the other hand, the Democrats got an increase in the earned income tax credit for poor people. Altogether, a win-win and a loss-loss for everybody. And the taxpayer, who is now facing, I think, about an $800 billion unpaid for hit in spending and tax cuts.
Robert Costa, we see that everybody is giving something here, but explain the dynamic, if you can, within the GOP on this. John Boehner had so much trouble bringing conservatives in his own party to the table on budget deals. Now, here we've got Paul Ryan bringing enough, along with Democrats, to make it happen. What's changed there, Robert?
What you see is a total divide between the grassroots part of the Republican Party and the GOP establishment. And Ryan is dealing with the same political headwinds that knocked down Boehner and forced him from office. There's an anger toward Washington, toward any kind of deal making. And Ryan, as someone who was elected in 1998, is a sort of an institutional presence within the House, is more of a governing Republican. And you see most of the presidential candidates, because they're trying to win a primary, moving away from that kind of posture.
Can this last, Robert? This feels like more old school deal making, like a budget deal in, you know, 1985 instead of 2015.
In a strange way, Tom, Ryan actually has more freedom to be a deal maker because the party has lurched so far to the right. And the way the House is composed, there's not going to be another census till 2020. Most people think Republicans will keep the House until then. He feels because he has capital, political capital, going back to his days working for Jack Kemp, his time in the conservative movement, he has more room to maneuver to cut a deal than a John Boehner, who wasn't seen as one of them by conservatives.
And Nancy, the oil exports from the United States, it's been a very long time since the oil crisis years, since that's gone on. Is this a big deal to world markets, or who pushed so hard for this? Is this all about more money for American producers?
Well, the Republicans had pushed for this. This is the end of a 40-year ban, so it's quite significant.
Yeah.
It comes at a time, though, when oil prices are below $40 a barrel, and you have competing countries coming in, Iran among them, offering oil. And so in the foreseeable future, it doesn't portend of a huge income because you have record low oil prices and a real increase in supply worldwide. And the United States now joins, ironically, Iran as a country that will start exporting crude oil.
Jack, you know, getting this through, and the Senate looking at it later on this day as we speak, but everybody's expecting it to go through. I feel like I'm having a Back to the Future moment here, like it's time travel. You know, hard negotiation, not everyone gets what they want, but a spending package is actually voted properly through it, and off we go. New day or just a timeout here, Jack?
It may just be a timeout. Next year is going to be tough, an election year. But my gosh, all credit to Paul Ryan, who clearly has managed to bring his caucus in line and to make tough decisions, tough trade-offs. That's what the Constitution envisioned for the House and for the Senate.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. The Fed, Baltimore, climate accord in Paris, Republicans in debate. Robert Costa is with us from The Washington Post. Nancy Youssef from The Daily Beast, senior national security correspondent there. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What did you see in the GOP debates this week? Can anybody stop, slow down Donald Trump? Is it Trump versus Clinton for the White House? Is that your guess now? And what's the message from the hung jury in Baltimore? Is the president sending the right message on terrorism? And yes, a federal spending bill looks like it is on its way to passage. Sam in Iowa City. Sam, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to comment on the federal spending bill, on how they also added the entire CISA internet surveillance bill into a clause. And I really disagree with that. I'd really like to know what your panelists think of that.
Let's go to Nancy Youssef. She covers national security. Thank you, Sam. Nancy, the cybersecurity has been an issue here. What is in this spending bill when it comes to cybersecurity and internet surveillance?
Well, Sam describes it exactly right, that this very controversial CISA provision was put into place. It's interesting that we're talking about cybersecurity and what it can do, because I think one of the lessons of, for example, San Bernardino is that the dependency on the internet and social media to find terrorists doesn't always work. That in fact, sometimes old school talking to people who've expressed others that they plan a terrorist attack. But
But what is this CISA? What is this provision? Does it toughen or loosen surveillance?
It allows the surveillance to continue, and that for some people is seen as a violation of privacy acts. And so that's one of the reasons it was so controversial. But it comes at a time when how much surveillance the United States should be doing is in question in light of Paris and San Bernardino.
And of course, also an issue in the campaigns. Robert Costa, we've seen some in the conservative Republican wing critical of this. Where's the primary opposition? Is it GOP or Democratic?
It's mostly Republican. I think you've seen Republicans really unsure about where they want to go as a party, Tom. I mean, there's no real consensus. It hasn't developed. It's not a lot of depth when it comes to the policy discussion.
On intelligence and surveillance, we'll look at that more in the context of the debate this week. William in Watersmeet, Michigan. William, you're on the air.
Yes. I'm calling regarding the Syria talks in at the UN.
Mm-hmm.
My opinion, I was born in Damascus.
Okay.
And the Assad family will never give up power. Never. And that means either you have to dislodge them. I mean, Putin has to then, maybe he's just now looking after Assad, making him look nice, but he has to shove him out of the way and somehow send the main leaders of the pack, send them out overseas with the 100 billion they have saved, plus they have ferreted out. And then how do you disarm the various divisions, the legions that are protecting the government and the party?
I mean, that cuts right to it, William.
There are only 17 secret services in the country.
Yeah, no, everybody's armed up. As you say, the Assads have certainly, the family has shown over a long time that they're scarcely willing to budge. Issue is if Moscow would do it or not, and then how all that dovetails into the conflict with the Islamic State. Islamic State, I mean, headlines this week, they launched an offensive in northern Iraq, and it was pushed back by the Kurds with some U.S. help, but pretty strong offensive when we've been told they're sort of back on your heels. This was a big issue in the Republican debate on Tuesday night in Las Vegas. Here was Ted Cruz of Texas, who had some prominence in that debate, saying, utterly destroy ISIS.
We need a president who understands the first obligation of the commander-in-chief is to keep America safe. If I am elected president, we will hunt down and kill the terrorists. We will utterly destroy ISIS.
All right. There's one way of going at it. I want to look at what other candidates and the administration are saying. Robert in Bethel, Vermont. Robert, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
First, before I share my points with the Syrian disaster, I wanted to say how disgusted and disappointed I was to find in the news that Ash Carter used a private server as the Department or the Secretary of Defense.
It does seem kind of funny after all the heat that Hillary Clinton has taken,
right,
that he would do that.
I think it's despicable, but I think President Obama should be sent off to Hawaii with a book called War 101. In Syria, we have two issues, ISIS and Assad. I think we should put Assad on the second priority. ISIS is a major problem. I think there's two men in the world who have their acts together. One is Amin Asari, and the former Syrian delegate, Frederick Cuff, I think his name is. But we need 250,000 troops from, 25,000 from 10 countries to get on the ground from north to south, just march north to south, take ISIS out of the program, and then sit down with Assad and deal with what we have to deal with.
So you're for the full-on war approach here. I want to pick it up. That's very interesting because, as my panel knows, President Obama was talking about this in some depth this week. Nancy, you may know, he brought in columnists and opinion writers and talked about how he sees this, why he doesn't want to go in heavy,
right,
saying that it would cost $10 billion a month, it would put 500 U.S. U.S. casualties every month, that we could end up also in Libya and Yemen, sort of a region-wide war. But you hear our caller saying, march in there, 250,000 troops, do the job.
I think he said 100, but regardless, what we're
hearing—
He
said 100 dead, 500 wounded.
That's right. What we're hearing from President Obama, frankly, is not someone who thinks he has a strategic problem, but a communications problem, which is why you heard him repeatedly this week, starting at the Pentagon on Monday, repeat his strategy. While what Robert is proposing is something that many argues outside of what the American public wants to do, another major large-scale operation in the Middle East. And what the military would argue is it's not convinced that even that could get rid of it, because what we're talking about is getting rid of an idea, getting rid of The lack of opportunity and the growth of fundamentalism that allows that idea to flourish, and that a military campaign doesn't necessarily do it. But I understand Robert's frustration, because you see this terror group and the United States has all this military prowess. It's hard to reconcile that the United States cannot take out a group that is promised to terrorize and has terrorized the world. But how you take out an idea with a military, that's the conundrum. And you're hearing a president say that while he says the goal is to destroy ISIS, the strategy that he's put out really keeps ISIS on its heels through airstrikes and a sprinkling, if you will, of special forces.
Robert Costa, clearly there are ideas at work here, but the Islamic State is now more than an idea. I mean, they are functioning in much of that region as a state. What about the Republican approach here, as we saw it laid out in Las Vegas this week in the debate?
The Republican approach is not so much a strategy or a consensus, but it's broad strokes, and it's.
Is it war, Robert? Is it? We will take the country to war if we get the White House.
Depends on what you mean by war, Tom.
Yeah, yeah.
Because when it comes to ground troops, there's an aversion within many in the Republican ranks. You see Donald Trump leading the field. He's more dovish isn't the word, but a non-interventionist when it comes to these strikes. And you see Ted Cruz talking about carpet bombing, but when it comes to the question of whether to put battalions on the ground in Syria and near Raqqa, they become a little more murky.
Jack,
Tom,
yes, please, Nancy.
I'm sorry. Can I just add, as someone who watched the debate, for all the sort of rhetoric, there wasn't a fundamental proposal in terms of the warfighting effort that was different than what the president has put forth. We can argue degrees, but there wasn't a major different strategic change in what was being proposed. What was the difference was the intensity, how many troops, how many airstrikes. But you didn't hear, to my ears, there was no talk of a fundamentally different approach to the war against ISIS itself. The intensity was different, but the foundations arguably were the same.
It is very interesting. Lots of ferociousness there. Jack, I'll come to you on this, but let's hear a little bit on the intelligence front as well, because that was a key sort of battle point between Rubio and Cruz at Tuesday's GOP debate. Rubio charging that Cruz had voted to end the bulk collection of American telephone metadata, that it weakened America's ability to fight terrorism. Here's Rubio.
The next time there is an attack on this country, the first thing people are going to want to know is, why didn't we know about it and why didn't we stop it? And the answer better not be because we didn't have access to records or information that would have allowed us to identify these killers before they attacked.
Senator Rubio looking for an opening in the armor of Ted Cruz there. I'll bring it to you, Jack. First, Carlos in Austin, Texas. Carlos, you're on. What do you think?
Hi. Thank you, Tom. First, I just want to comment that in having come from the military and having been an intelligence analyst myself, a lot of the talk behind this whole notion of shutting down portions of the internet and, you know, taking away the wireless wiretapping is hurting our ability to combat terrorism. It's all just fear-mongering. The reality is that Edward Snowden revealed more things that actually aided the enemy than actually protected Americans. There are numerous things that he revealed that doesn't help anybody. And then on top of that, there's this whole notion, this 20th century mindset of shutting down pipes and valves as though the internet is some sort of ridiculous, you know, mixture of tubes, like it's, you know, sewage. And it just doesn't work that way.
But wait, Carlos, you were in military intelligence and you're saying we need more internet surveillance or not?
No, it's not about needing more or less. It's about targeting the right people. And the problem is that there's a sufficient amount of red tape, but there isn't a sufficient amount of oversight over the gatekeepers. And that's really what it comes down to. There's no, the legislation is very murky, and there's actually very little transparency. And so that's the central issue.
Carlos, we've got it, and I appreciate your call from Texas. Jack Beatty, how do you see this, both within the Republican field that we saw on stage? No doubt we'll hear some more on this from Democrats on Saturday night. The White House view that President Obama's putting out there this week, it was kind of a rope-a-dope isn't exactly right, but let's just steadily sort of eat away at the Islamic State until they fall. But you heard Ash Carter in the tape we played saying, hey, we need the whole world involved in this. It seems like a lot of mixed messages, Jack.
There are. However, I didn't get a mixed message out of that Las Vegas Fear Fest. I got, I got a scary candidate in Chris Christie and a lucky one in Ted Cruz. Christie, you know, he really revealed himself as a Barry Goldwater without the wit.
I mean, no-fly zone, and if we have to shoot down Russian planes, okay.
So what? I mean, he broke new ground in political desperation, becoming the first candidate ever to say, vote for me, and I'll attack a nuclear power. Cruz's luck was to share the stage and really good poll numbers with Trump. George W. Bush, he really spoke for practically everybody who's known Cruz when he said, I just don't like the guy. It's risky nominating the Grinch of American politics. At Clinton Central in Brooklyn, you know, they pray for Cruz as an opponent because of his 10% flat tax, which would be paid for by a 19% national sales tax. That's a hard sell to Americans with a body temperature of 98.6. For the moment, only the tumescent embarrassment of Trump is really masking the political vulnerability of Cruz.
And, of course, we had Chris Christie saying he would threaten Vladimir Putin in a big hurry. Interesting, at the end of his annual year-end press conference on Thursday, the Russian president, Putin, told reporters that the U.S. Republican candidate Donald Trump is the man to watch. Here's Vladimir Putin interpreted by the Washington Post on Trump.
He is a very flamboyant man, very talented, no doubt about that. He is an absolute leader of the presidential race, as we see it today.
Kind of a, is that a mutual admiration society? I don't know, with Putin and Trump. Robert Costa, give us some interpretation here on how this is evolving. Do Republicans still look at Trump with his pretty strong national poll numbers and say he can be unhorsed here? If he cannot, what? And if he can, then I don't even know when I ask who the party's rooting for anymore, who I'm asking about exactly. But is Cruz seen as a guy who can go effectively up against the Democrats for the presidency?
Cruz is well organized, and when it comes to winning the Republican nomination, he's perhaps best positioned to take on Trump because when you look at how the calendar unfolds, you have the early states, and then on March 1st, the Super Tuesday primaries in the southern area, and that is a Cruz territory, no doubt about it. But Trump is not fading at all. I've been on the campaign trail for the past few weeks, Tom, and it is striking how many conservative voters who are unhappy with their own party, unhappy with President Obama, are sticking with him, warts and all.
What does it mean, Robert? I mean, we saw his great big plane pull into Arizona, Phoenix this week, and lots of people waiting there for him. And he steps off like he's stepping off of Air Force One. The image of a billionaire running for the presidency is something new to me. But it's more than just rejectionist, and it's got this nuance in it where he's not exactly, as you say, it's not clear he'd be an interventionist, though most other people, most of the rest of the guys on the stage there, and Carly Fiorina seem to be saying, tough, tough, tough.
He's changed the Republican Party, whether or not he wins the nomination. The Putin press conference is so telling because when it comes to foreign policy, Trump often says, let Syria and Russia duke it out in the Middle East. He wants the United States to be less involved. And when it comes to the party as a whole, he's not a traditional Republican at all. He's a populist. He's a nationalist. He's anti-immigration reform. He's conservative on economics, but more about trade and cutting better deals. It's a totally different pitch, and it's taken the party by storm. And no one really knows how to deal with it.
Elaine in Brookline, Massachusetts. Elaine, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So my comment is I watched the debate. I don't know why the GOP isn't throwing tons of money behind Marco Rubio. He fulfills everything on their wish list demographically. He's Latino. He's young. Women would come along. And the other thing, the big bonus is he's the one person who can mend a broken party. So I'd like to hear what your panel has to say about that.
What about Marco Rubio as the, I don't know, savior candidate here, Robert? How do your GOP contacts look at that?
Well, I've spoken to several senators, Republicans, who are up for re-election next year, and they would love to have their colleague, Senator Rubio, on the ticket for the reasons the caller brought up. But the problem for Senator Rubio, is when you look at the map, it's not really clear where he would win. He's behind in Iowa, though steady there. New Hampshire is in his state. It's crowded in the establishment lane, and Jack would probably know about that. And then South Carolina, he's well organized, but again, behind. And so really, in this kind of race in a crowded field, he fits the profile the party wants, but he doesn't really have a base.
Jack, how do you look at young Mr. Senator Rubio?
Well, you know, he has the dilemma of the omni-attractive candidate. He appeals to all groups in the Republican Party. Polls show that, but not to any one group intensely in the way that Cruz does, in the way that Trump does. So therefore, it's very hard to see, you know, where his vote is now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Star Wars The Force Awakens hit U.S. theaters last night. Fans eating it up.
Chewie, we're home.
Soccer star Abby Wambach played her last game on Wednesday. In the 2011 World Cup, the U.S. down a goal against Brazil. Wambach headed the ball in to tie up the game, voted the greatest goal in FIFA Women's World Cup history.
I know that my career has come full circle. I feel very complete about it.
And the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame announced its inductees for 2016, including Cheap Trick, Chicago, and NWA.
Or they ban my group from the radio here in WA and say, hell no. But you know it ain't all about wealth. As long as you make a note to spread yourself.
We're looking at a week in the news. The Fed makes its move, a mistrial in Baltimore, climate accord in Paris, Republican debate. Robert Costa is with us, national political reporter at the Washington Post. You see him on NBC, MSNBC as well. Nancy Youssef is here, senior national security correspondent for the Daily Beast. And, of course, our own news analyst Jack Beattie is here. You can join us. What are you thinking on the hung jury in Baltimore, on Paris, the big accord there, on the Fed and its move? Soccer great Abby Wambach's last game. Is the Star Wars force pulling you in? Six officers in the spotlight in the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore. First trial there, mistrial, hung jury. Here was chanting afterward.
Right! Convict! Take those killer cops to jail! The whole damn system is guilty as hell!
The whole damn system is guilty as well. Here's Wesley Weth of Faith Empowered Ministries, activist in the Black Lives Matter movement in Baltimore, talking with reporters in the case of Officer William Porter.
It's time for change. It's time now, man. A mistrial is not what we need. We need those officers convicted and thrown in jail.
Jack Beattie, what do you see here? We've got more trials to come. There's going to be another one in this case. They just, the jury, I mean, it was predominantly a black jury, not entirely. And I don't know what the count was, but they couldn't come to unanimity. Baltimore, there were fears it could go up in flames again, as it did last summer. It did not, but there's a lot of passion here.
Yes, if it had been an acquittal, we don't know what would have happened. A very muted verdict, and one with, as the papers point out, a potentially large effect on other prosecutions, notably of the driver of the van. This man, Porter, will have to be tried again. And the prosecution couldn't get even sort of misconduct charges against him. That really, I think, has to shake the prosecution. I mean, it would seem that there was misconduct of some kind, at least carelessness. You can leave out sort of the quasi-deliberate charge of manslaughter is too much, but they couldn't even get that one. That's not a good sign.
We've got much more to watch there. Chicago, lots of tension there. Rahm Emanuel still very much in the hot seat on race and police issues there. Ross in Middletown, Connecticut. Ross, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'd just like to talk about the race for the Democratic nomination for a second.
Sure.
Earlier today or late last night, it came out that the Democratic National Committee is actually shutting off Bernie Sanders' campaign from voter data that every campaign uses to reach out to likely Democratic voters and primary and caucus.
And this is because, Ross, there was some kind of a breach here that gave a software glitch, and the assertion is that one of Bernie Sanders' staff members used that to look at Hillary Clinton's private campaign data. Now the whole campaign being disciplined by being cut off from that voter database. What do you think, Ross?
Well, from what the news is reporting, it sounds like this is not the first time something like this has happened, and the campaign worker who did it was actually fired already. And this is not the first time that the Democratic National Committee has done something that it does follow the rules, but it also stacks the deck against the Sanders campaign. For example, putting this next upcoming debate on what is essentially a holiday weekend while a football game is going on.
And not to mention every Christmas party in the country.
Yeah,
Ross,
you know,
I'm glad you raised it. Jack, I hear you.
I was going to say, the quip of the week came from a spokesman for the Sanders campaign who said about the dating of this this debate, I guess Christmas Eve was booked.
Yeah, right. Robert Costa, what about shutting Bernie Sanders' campaign off from this voter data? There was some kind of glitch, and the assertion is that his campaign took undue advantage of it. Ross looks at this and says, this doesn't look like equitable treatment. It looks like the party leaning toward Hillary Clinton, I guess.
This has been the concern for Sanders supporters for months. They're unhappy with the way the Democratic National Committee has structured this primary. I mean, just think about this weekend. I was talking to a Sanders ally yesterday, and they said the debate's on a Saturday, and they don't understand why the debates aren't getting that much attention, and they look at the Republican side and they think it's totally different. And so this is just the Sanders campaign again, wondering when are they going to get attention and how.
Well, Saturday night is going to be tough. We'll talk about their debate on Monday, but you know, everybody's out on this Saturday night. Good heavens. David in New Orleans, Louisiana. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
It's interesting that Bernie Sanders came up in the conversation, because actually I was calling. You're saying, like, is there any way to beat Donald Trump? We're talking about the Republican debate.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I found very interesting is I lost track. I mean, I had to be at least four dozen times that Hillary Clinton was mentioned. The Republican Party clearly wants to run a general election against Hillary Clinton. If there's anybody who can beat Donald Trump, who mentioned during the debate that he can beat Hillary in the latest polls, which is true, the only person who beats Donald Trump in a head-to-head matchup is Bernie Sanders. But that doesn't get mentioned. His name is not mentioned in debates. It's as if he's not even running for office. But I guarantee you, Bernie Sanders appeals to independents and Republicans, who are now called rhinos by many of their party members. Much more support for those people, for Bernie Sanders, than Hillary Clinton could ever muster. So if there's anybody who can beat Donald Trump and stop his country from devolving into fascism, which is what most of his policies sound like to me, then I think people need to get behind Bernie Sanders, look at his campaign website.
David, we've got it. You're feeling the burn there in New Orleans. Robert Costa, what about it in the polls? I mean, David's asserting that head-to-head polling, Bernie Sanders does better than Hillary Clinton against Trump. Have you seen that?
I think that poll number, and I've seen it, is more of a testament to the national mood than any kind of strength for Trump or Sanders specifically, because you see on both sides a revulsion toward Wall Street, toward the big banks, and Trump, even though he's a billionaire, I think his supporters are more close to Senator Sanders than they are to a Marco Rubio or a Jeb Bush supporter. And that what we're seeing is the current in the country.
Jack, there'll be a debate. We'll talk about it on Monday. Is it looking foregone to you with the timing here and everything else?
Yes. I mean, there's really only an election in one state now, this one, New Hampshire. Bernie Sanders is ahead. One poll has him 10 points ahead. Beyond here, before here in Iowa, Hillary now is pretty well ahead. And then forward from New Hampshire, she's ahead in South Carolina by 50 points. It looks like it's an election that's coming down to one state.
Well, we'll see. He's still got that fire when he's on the stump. He's got passionate supporters. He's got the poll that our caller in New Orleans points to. I want to take it across the Atlantic for a moment. Now, this was a week ago, Saturday anyway, in Paris. After all the long drumroll and anticipation, the huge gathering of heads of state, there are all the questions about whether they could pull together on a deal. A deal was reached. Here was the French foreign minister, Laurent Fabius, announcing the deal in Paris, interpreted by the BBC.
I see that the reaction is positive. I see no objections. The Paris Agreement is adopted.
Nancy Youssef, a lot of people would look at climate issues as maybe the number one national security concern, global security concern, for that matter. Over time, President Obama has certainly spoken about it in almost those terms. What do you see in this deal? A real step toward a turn in global energy and emissions policy, or hope?
Well, it's hard to dismiss it when there are 195 countries that signed on and that these were agreements for the next 100 years. The real goal of it was to stem greenhouse emissions in the coming century.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, it even dealt with the results of climate change now, calling for things like infrastructure for seawalls and programs to deal with poor soil. And so this was a really concerted effort. Now, what's interesting about this deal is that it is and it is not legally binding. Portions of it are in terms of reporting numbers, if you will. But these agreements are not legally binding. One of the lessons of the Kyoto Agreement of the late 90s was that that was not received as well. And so it'll be interesting. What it's essentially calling for is for nations to volunteer to acknowledge that climate change is happening and to make efforts. That both the United States and China agreed was particularly important because those two countries alone are responsible for 30% of the world's emissions.
Robert Costa, the U.S. emerged as a leader in Paris, but ironically, while there were lots of GOP attacks on all this at home, what does that portend to your mind to the future of American policy here?
It's up in the air. If a Democrat wins the White House in 2016, I think you're going to see a continuation of what President Obama is doing. But it's such a distinct difference with the Republican Party and how they even talk about the issue. There's disbelief about climate change. Most Republican-based voters are very suspicious of it. And so you have on one side the Democrats and President Obama operating as a leader in these talks and putting the United States at the fore. But should a Republican win, there will be a lot of pressure from the party ranks to break away.
Jack, President Obama talking today about what he's accomplished in this year as he goes through San Bernardino and is on his way for a Christmas holiday. But there's Paris, and he certainly had his administration put its shoulder to the wheel of that effort.
He played a catalyzing role, really, you know, from the unprecedented investment in green energy made in the stimulus bill to raising CAFE standards for cars and trucks, issuing the first ever carbon pollution standards for existing power plants, to the game-changing, really, bilateral agreement with China to curb emissions, which really set Paris up for success. All of these steps, the president has met the challenge of our time and perhaps of all time. It could come to naught. A Republican president could reverse his steps, and certainly, by itself, Paris will only delay the worst. It really doesn't do more than that. It needs follow-on. Still, when you concede all that, it's really not the time to begrudge the tenuous achievement of Barack Obama. Republican politicians deride it. Marco Rubio called Paris a farce. But you know, their grandchildren may remember Paris and this president with gratitude.
Of course, follow-on is an easy thing to say, but it's big, dramatic steps required down the road where consensus and the initiative continue to be focused will be a big, big deal in terms of how this turns out for the planet. Abby in Nashville. Abby, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I really just have a comment. I am just so proud as a former soccer player of Abby Wambach.
Yeah.
When I first started playing soccer as a girl, I had to play on the boys' team because there wasn't girls' teams. And I'm just so proud of kind of the ripple effect that she's had on women's sports and particularly youth women's sports. And what an impact that she's made.
Abby, I'm right there with you. I mean, her play on the field, I've always loved to watch it. Her poise off the field and sort of confidence, just amazing. When you watch Abby Wambach play, it is amazing that you used to have to play on a boys' team, Abby.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, Abby and I are about the same age, and just how far she has come and just what a great role model she is for young women. It's just someone, especially with the all the noises around our athletes today, it's just someone that you can really look up to for our young women.
I'm glad you called to say and acknowledge exactly that. Nancy Youssef, I feel it. Are you feeling it?
Of course. I mean, I'm someone who travels all over the world, and to have those kinds of symbols of women empowerment is something that resonates not only here, but you hear it overseas too, which is a wonderful thing, particularly in a climate when so often the United States is talked about as part of the political polarization that we're seeing across the world.
Here's another large and in charge woman this week on the policy front, Janet Yellen, chair of the Federal Reserve.
It reflects the committee's confidence that the economy will continue to strengthen. The economic recovery has clearly come a long way, although it is not yet complete.
And there, as she announced bumping up interest rates, just a tiny titch, 0.25% or so, but for the first time in almost a decade, Jack, no sense after all the anticipation and stock markets threatening to wobble, no sense that this is a derailing thing. People seem kind of comforted by it. Now, I know the markets were up and then the markets were down, but it doesn't look like a game changer right now.
No, but a change in direction, certainly. You know, the Yellen and before that Bernanke Fed, they really have carried the recovery since the GOP takeover of the House slammed shut the possibility of a fiscal stimulus. They deserve credit. They won't get it from Republicans, they really made dire predictions about Fed policy that haven't been borne out. Marco Rubio wants now to the Fed to ignore unemployment when setting rates, which is perhaps the wrong lesson to draw from this experiment in expansion, which really has seen unemployment cut in half from its 2009 peak. Ted Cruz goes Rubio one better. He wants the Fed to, quote, stop juicing the economy and to peg future rates to the gold standard. That's the policy that dragged the world into the Great Depression.
Nancy Youssef, another name very much out front this week, Bo Bergdahl. There had been a push to, I think, charge him with nothing, but now big generals come in, he's going to be court-martialed. What's the significance of this case? He walked away from his camp in Afghanistan. He was taken prisoner. We got him back in a swap. What's the significance of this, Nancy?
Well, it was surprising because those on the military side who had a say recommended against it, that his 5 years in prison by the Taliban was punishment enough. And so that this judge decided otherwise portends of a very controversial trial in a case that's already deeply divided the military.
Podcast Serial is out. They're going to have a lot of that for us to listen to. I'm sure many will. We'll learn a lot more about Bo Bergdahl there. Nancy Youssef, senior national security correspondent for the Daily Beast. It's always wonderful to have you here. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, and congratulations on your podcast.
Best of. We love it. Robert Costa, national political reporter at the Washington Post. Thank you for joining us.
Appreciate it, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, great to have you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Yes, On Point, the podcast. Don't miss it. iTunes, best of 2015. We're right in the thick of it. And listeners, on Christmas Eve, we're airing an hour of Christmas stories. We would love to hear yours. Call us at 617-353-0683 by December 21st with your Christmas story. We can't wait to hear it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.